I thought she was in here with you. Now that you say it, Tekla said, turning in an ineffectual circle to scan the room, I haven't seen her for quite a while. Well, you ought to have been watching her. Find her when you've got the coffee out and make sure her apron's on straight. She's probably filthy dirty by now. When Hilda rejoined her guests, she was smiling, but she darted anxious glances toward the door until Tekla had safely deposited all the coffee cups and the two coffee pots on the side table. Stolen in just a minute, Hilda announced and began pouring out. Cream and sugar, Mrs. Jensen. Leota Prunerstorfen, who didn't care for coffee and was hoping a pot of tea might also appear from the kitchen, saw Ruth first. Ruth Newman, what the dickens have you got on? Then everyone had to look at the little girl standing in the doorway, proudly holding the tray of sugar and cream before her, pins stuck in all directions out of her hair. Her cheeks were smeared a brilliant red, and her little arms were stuck through the straps of some large, lace-trimmed pink garment that hung down to her ankles. "Why, she's wearing a corset!" Leota exclaimed, and then clapped her hand over her mouth, shocked at her own words. Best, Carl thought, to act as if this were a joke, and he began to smile, looking at Ruth. Now that she did not quite look like the little girl he knew, he suddenly recognized Matilda's playfulness in her. And the idea made him sad, but also comforted, in fact, almost happy. It was the first time since her death that he'd thought of his wife and felt happy. Carefully, Hilda set the cup she was holding down on the tray. And then, looking neither right nor left, not stopping for a coat, she walked through the room and out the front door into the chilly April afternoon. Mary Louise had lifted Ruth under the arms. "Let's get you cleaned up," she said, and carried her upstairs. "We ought to be going," Hattie Jensen said, pushing her chair away from the table decisively, and that galvanized the group. They got up, and someone thought to send Tekla for the coats, and to everyone's relief there was much noise and confusion sorting out whose was whose. "She'll get over it," Ida Brummer said to Carl. "Yes," Dolly Brennan said, giving him a motherly pat on the shoulder. "By supper time she'll be right as rain again, you'll see." But they didn't know Hilda. At dawn the next morning, she was waiting in the kitchen with her bags packed. "My train leaves at 7:05. "But who'll take care of Ruth?" Carl asked helplessly. Hilda looked at him scornfully. "She's the devil's child," she said. "Let him take care of her." The sun was warm by the time Carl returned from the station, though the air still whispered of winter. While he collected the eggs and slopped the pigs, Ruth drew patterns with a stick in the mud outside the pig pen. When the animals were fed, Carl lifted Ruth out of the dirt, intending to carry her in. She shrieked and clutched the fence post, straining away from him with all of her strength. Her boots left muddy streaks on his trousers, and she'd soiled herself. He could smell it. 5 years old, and no better than an animal. He kicked the fence in frustration. "Then stay there." He let her slither down his leg and drop back into the muck. He stalked off, walking as fast as his bad leg would allow, and didn't look back until he was inside the house. Then, from the kitchen window, he watched her as he made his coffee. She had thrown away her stick and was using the heel of her hand now to push ditches in the dirt, and then the flat of her palm to wipe them smooth again. The sun beat through the glass, and the yellow kitchen clock ticked thickly over his head. He opened the window, and Ruth glanced up for a moment, startled. She seemed surprised to see the house, to see the window with him in it. She frowned and lowered her eyes again quickly, as if she hadn't meant to look. What the hell was he supposed to do with her? The cat jumped up on the counter and rubbed its back against his elbow. He lifted his coffee cup and swallowed the dregs, rinsed it, and left it on the drainboard. He moved toward the door, but turned back again. He wiped the cup with one of his shirt tails and placed it gently upside down in the cupboard. When he picked her up, she screamed again, but this time he held on. He bathed her, dressed her in her best dress. He combed her fine straight hair and fixed a huge blue bow to the top of her head. Then he put a fresh shirt on himself and hitched the horse to the buggy, and they set off for St. Michael's. The wheels of the buggy jounced recklessly over the rutted road, and Carl devoted all of his attention to the driving. When they reached the well-groomed track that led up the hill to the sanatorium, he glanced at Ruth on the seat beside him. The bow was half undone, and had slipped down her head, and her hair looked as if it had never been brushed. What was that clump in the back? Burrs? One stocking had slipped to her ankle. The shoe on the other foot had come untied. Her dress had bunched strangely over her sash. She was disintegrating before his eyes. He clucked Frenchy on and drove faster. The track was carved through a thick wood, and branches sliced the sunlight into a thousand pieces. At the top of the hill, the trees thinned, and the building emerged, cream-colored brick, 5 stories high and square. A smaller building on the right, of Lannan stone and newer construction, housed the director and his family, consisting of a wife, 2 roly-poly boys, and an Irish setter. The children and the dog were chasing each other about the green lawn and paid no attention to Carl and Ruth as they went inside. The place had once been a monastery, and the monks' former cells were now private or semi-private rooms. But except that the windows and heavy doors could be locked only from the outside, the atmosphere was one of a spa, or so Carl imagined. Cream and maroon tiles formed the floor of the vestibule and of the lobby, easy to care for, yet attractive. The stairway was made of a dark, highly polished wood. Occasionally a cacophony would echo through the halls, a sudden scream, a laugh that continued too long, or a spitting stream of imprecations, but most of the patients, at least those in Amanda's wing, kept their troubles to themselves. He was familiar to the receptionist, and she looked up from the letter she was writing just long enough to smile and wave them on. "She's upstairs this morning," she said. He removed his hat and climbed the uncarpeted stairs, pausing on the second-floor landing to smooth back his hair and straighten his tie, and to gaze out the window down at the boys who were now doing their best to ride the dog. Ruth's little hand worked its way into his. Outside the door of room 312, he stopped. He knelt in front of Ruth and tried to put her costume back together. "Ruthie," he said, "you behave now. If you're good, she might come home. All right? You be good." She stared at Amanda's door and said nothing. He sighed, straightened, and knocked. Like Ruth, Amanda gave no answer, but then she never did. His knock was a warning rather than a request. He opened the door and gently pushed Ruth ahead of himself into the room. "Look who I've brought to see you today, Amanda." Tentatively, as if she thought Ruth might only be an illusion, Amanda rose from her chair and reached to touch the girl's face with her fingertips. Ruth jumped back. "I hate you," she shouted. "I hate you." Carl stared at her, more shocked by the fact she was speaking than by what she said. Amanda stared at her, too. Horrified at her own words, Ruth backed away, back and back, until, "Ruthie, be careful!" But it was too late. She'd lost her balance on the stairs and fell bumping and sliding to the landing. Amanda reached her first, gathered her in her arms, rocked her as she screamed, her lip bloody from banging against her teeth. "It's all right, Ruthie, it's all right," she said. "For a moment there you were flying. I saw it. You were really flying." At last Ruth's sobs became quiet tears, and she snuggled her face into Amanda's shoulder. "Aunt Mandy," she whispered.
"What, Ruthie?"
"You can come home now. I made her go away." Amanda. She was reckless just like you, Maddie. After you learned to walk, you ran from room to room, shrieking and laughing. I told you to be careful, but you wouldn't stop. You would never stop until you tripped and fell or pinched your finger in a door. And then how you would scream and cry as if you were the only one who had ever gotten hurt. You were only 4 the first time you followed me through the winter woods. I was already halfway across the ice when I heard your voice. "Wait, Mandy, wait!" I turned and saw you, so ungainly in your layers of wool, the peak on your brown velvet cap drooping as you struggled toward me over the ice. "Go away!" I shouted, my voice booming across the glassy lake. "Leave me alone!" But you never cared what I said, did you? Not when you wanted your way. You scuffled on, your boots scratching along the snowy ice. I started back, all set to drag you home. Why should I share my island with you? But you reached me before I'd gone 10 steps, and you grabbed my leg with your mittened hands to steady yourself. "Please take me with you, Mandy." I couldn't refuse you. The island was better, so much better with two. Remember the little lean-to we built out there? Remember our garden, our crops? You wanted radishes, and I thought we should have nasturtiums. We planted them both, remember? And remember when you were a queen? You made a crown out of honeysuckle. You painted your face with bloodroot. Go to Saskatoon, you said to the dragonflies, and bring me back some salt. What's a queen's name? You asked me, your hair all draggled, your face dirty. What should my name be if I'm the queen? Imogene, I said. I only thought of it because it rhymed, but you decided it was the prettiest name you'd ever heard. From then on, whenever we were on the island, you wanted me to call you Imogene. Remember that? Queen Imogene. Do you remember? We would wade out into the water and splash, and when it got too deep for you, you would cling to me, your little arms around my neck, your skinny legs hooked around my middle, weightless in the buoying water. I loved that, your holding tight that way, your needing me to hold you up. You felt safe with me. You knew I would take care of you. But then, somehow, you began to drift away. Just a few inches at first. You would let go with your legs but keep your arms tight, or loosen your arms but keep your legs locked around me. I told you no. I told you to hold on tight, but you wouldn't. You began to let go altogether, a moment here, a moment there, ducking underwater and then grabbing hold of me again, dashing the water from your eyes with one hand and coughing. But I scolded you. I held tight to your smooth, slippery skin. It's not safe, I told you. You stay with me. I wouldn't let you swim away. I wouldn't let you go. You should have listened to me, Maddie, when I told you to go back. You should have left me alone. You and Ruth, with your wailing and your crying, letting the whole world know my business, why couldn't you let me go? Why did you let me go, Maddie? I told you to hold on. I would never have let you go, but you made me. It was you. You made me do it. I'll never forgive you. Never. Wait, Maddie. I'm not angry. Don't be scared. I won't scold you. I'm laughing. See? It's all right. I didn't mean it. You can come back now, Maddie. You hear me? Come back. Chapter 7. Amanda. All of that with Clement Owens was water under the bridge. A month gone, at least, by March 1919, when I went home to start over, to start fresh with Maddie and her baby Ruth. The trouble was, I didn't feel much better at home than I'd felt working at the hospital, and after what had happened the last time I'd come home ill, I was cautious. Better not get too close, I warned Maddie the next morning, when I staggered in from the milking after losing my breakfast behind the barn. Still, there was no fever. And now that I was away from the hospital, I was sure I'd be able to shake it. It's nothing, I snapped, when on the third or fourth day Maddie suggested I call Dr. Cobbler. I'm a nurse, aren't I? Don't you think I know? I'd bowed out of kitchen duty and stuck to outdoor chores, despite my promises that first night, because the thought of food made me queasy, and the fresh air seemed to help. On Friday, Maddie announced that she'd made me a treat. "This'll bring your appetite back," she said, dramatically sweeping the platter of perch from the oven where she'd been keeping it warm. Perch had always been one of my favorite dishes, but that evening I broke into a sweat and could barely make it outside in time. "Too bad," Maddie said later, feeding me crackers and cheese. But Pickles was pleased. She ate a whole fish. Then she giggled. "What?" Oh, I was just thinking of that last time Perch made me sick, back when I was carrying Ruth. Poor Carl. He swore he'd never go fishing again. She smiled. But I couldn't smile, for Matilda's words had caught me. After she'd gone to her room, I struggled to fling them off. I got up and paced. I threw open the window and thrust my head into the cold air. But the harder I tried to escape, the more firmly the idea set in my brain. It was true, all right. I'd tried to pretend otherwise. I'd told myself it was only worry or grief or loneliness that was making me dizzy and tired and sick. But I hardly needed to be a nurse to realize that something more solid than unhappiness was growing inside of me. I'd tried to return to the way things were, but it was no use. Coming home couldn't change me back into the girl I'd once been. All I could think to do was run away again. When I was certain that Maddie and Ruth were asleep, I packed my bag and sat on the edge of my bed, one hand pressed against my abdomen, and thought about where I could go to get away from this thing. There were places I knew where the sisters took you in until it was over, even if you weren't Catholic. I'd heard about another nurse going to one of those places, and now I shuddered at the shame and scorn I'd felt for her. Frida, her name was. Maybe that's what I'd call myself. I'd go there. The sisters would teach me how to pray. Maybe I'd stay on afterward, become a nun. But they probably didn't let you do that. Thinking that I could never become a nun, I started to cry. It was a silly thing to cry about. I didn't even want to be a nun. Still, I burrowed my head into the pillow and sobbed. Then I lay for a long time with my face on the wet pillowcase. At least Mama and Papa wouldn't know, I thought. At least they were safe from my shame. I drew my feet up on the bed without taking off my shoes. Downstairs, Matilda was playing the piano and singing, "Hello, my baby, hello, my honey, hello, my ragtime girl." Now and then a discordant note rang out, and I knew Ruth was on her lap, her little palms patting the keys, because once I'd sat on my mother's lap in just that way. I was so tired suddenly. So tired I decided that I could spend one more night at home. No one knew the truth. No one was likely to know it for months. I could afford a little sleep. Mama always went into the back room when she felt one of her spells coming on. She drew the curtains and lay on the daybed, turning her face to the wall and squeezing a pillow over her ears to keep the cicadas' hum and the bird songs out. My father would close her door. "You see how it hurts her when you don't act right," he would say to me. "Now be good and quiet." And then he would leave the house. I tried to be good and quiet. I went up to my room and played with my doll or looked at my picture book. But after a while, I always got scared, thinking of my mother in that dark room all by herself, thinking she might be crying, thinking she might be dead, thinking she might have gone away. So I crept downstairs and carefully, silently turned the knob and pushed open the door a crack, just to see, just to make sure. And, of course, she was always there, her back to the room, her head buried. Except the one time she wasn't. The day bed was empty. The blanket that usually covered her shoulders was crumpled on the floor. The room was small, but I ran across it and dropped to the floor to look under the furniture. No, she was gone. I searched then the bedrooms, the kitchen cupboards, the wardrobe, the pantry. I asked the hired girl who was wringing out clothes on the back porch, "Where's my mama, Gert?" "She's got to be somewheres. Maybe she went to town." Gert didn't know Mama the way I did. Mama wouldn't go to town sick. She wouldn't go without telling me. I tried to open the trap door that led to the attic. I thought of how goblins and witches might have snatched her away. I thought of how she would be calling to me, frightened, her arms stretching for me from a place I couldn't see. I thought finally of a likely place, the outhouse, but she wasn't there either. I walked through the barn, calling her, checking all the stalls. Finally, running back to the house, I noticed that the cellar door was open. I stepped slowly down into the damp darkness, keeping my shoulder tight against the wall so I wouldn't pitch off the open side of the stairs. At the bottom, I found her, sitting on the dirt floor, her forehead pressed against the sweating stone. She turned to me then, her face strangely white in the dimness. But she wasn't my mother. She mocked me. "Mama! Mama!" she said, making fun of the way I'd been calling her. Then she rolled her eyes to the ceiling. "Please, keep that intolerable child quiet," she said. I didn't know what child she meant. It wasn't until years later that I realized she meant me. When I woke the next morning, I knew where I wanted to run to, a place where no one need ever know, no one except Maddie. I was still dressed from the night before, still wearing my shoes, in fact, and I clomped downstairs and built a fire in the stove. I began to make French toast, turning my face away when it came time to crack the sickening egg. Maddie loved French toast. "Better?" she yawned, sinking into her chair at the table. Maddie was always slow to wake. Much, I flipped the toast. I did feel better, and for a moment I allowed myself to hope that I might have been wrong in my thinking the night before. But then I saw the remains of the perch in the cat's bowl and gagged. Listen, Maddie, I said, sitting beside her and pushing the sugar bowl away so that I could lean close. I was thinking we might want to move to the island for the summer. You and me and Ruthie. The fields are rented anyway. Rudy can take care of the animals. Why should we stay? When she didn't answer, I pressed on. It'll be fun, like taking a trip, just you and me and Ruthie. Oh, no, Amanda, it's too cold. She cut the corner off her toast. No, it's not. Or at least it'll only be cold for a few more weeks. It's already April. And think how easy it'll be to move things over on the ice. On the ice? Amanda, what are you thinking? The ice must be rotten now. We'll go through. No, we won't. The spring's been so cold, I'm sure it's good. I'd check it first, of course, I'd make sure. And if I went through, well, so much the better, I thought bitterly. Mandy, you have no idea how bleak and cold that island is this time of year. It's all right for an hour in the afternoon when you want a place to skate to, but not to live on day after day, night after night. You forgot. I've done it. I know what it's like. I thought I'd go crazy some of those days. That's right. You have done it, haven't you? You've had a chance. Where's my chance, I'd like to know? Who is it that found that island, after all? You and Carl would never have had such a cozy little spot if it hadn't been for me. I worked every angle, while Maddie chewed nervously on the ends of her hair. It was difficult to change her mind, but I knew I could do it if I tried hard enough. I was the elder, after all. I knew better. Rudy didn't like it either. You two girls out there alone? He clucked, shaking his head. No good. But there'll be three of us, I teased. I knew how to handle Rudy. We'll have Ruthie. I chose not to remind him that I, for one, could hardly be called a girl anymore. This time, though, he frowned. You know what I mean, Manda. You could freeze. It's not all that warm yet. You could burn the house down. We could do those things here, too, Rudy, Matilda said. Although I barely convinced her to go along with my plan, this new attitude didn't surprise me. Matilda was always more inclined to do something when you argued for the opposite. I reminded him that one of us would check in every few days, and if he was worried, all he needed to do was come out for a visit. I was pretty sure he'd never do this. Rudy was the wait-and-see type. Flames would have to be shooting from the island before he'd decide he'd better have a look. Oh, I knew everyone so well. Everyone except myself, and now this other one I carried in me. We'll wave every day at noon, Matilda said. It took us only 2 days to organize ourselves, to pack and arrange with the grocer and the butcher, to deliver food to the locker on our tiny beach as soon as the ice was out. We'd go to the farm, at least Maddie would, for butter and eggs and milk, and soon we'd plant our own vegetables. Rudy kept bringing more things in from the barn and adding them to the pile, lanterns and wrenches and oil. This'll come in handy, you'll see. And Matilda kept piling on the books. Just three more, she pleaded when I claimed the sled was getting too heavy. We were forgetting essential items, but we were only going a mile. It would always be easy to come back. At least it would be easy for Matilda. And so it was easy for her to go. It was a game to her, hardly different from when we were young and went to the island for relief from our real lives at home. But for me, it was serious. I would be different when I came back, if I ever did come back. We set off in the morning, so as to take as much advantage of the light as we could. The sky was gray, the snow old and frozen hard. It was the kind of day that makes you fear that God, distracted by finer things, has forgotten you. But Ruth had no such worry. She went before the sled, carrying an icicle like a torch, pushing her feet purposefully into the crunching snow, and announcing herself to the world in high-pitched, dissonant notes. "Wait a minute," I said when we got to the edge of the lake. I have to test the ice. I put my hand on Matilda's sleeve to hold her back. It had been a cold march, but still it was late in the season, and there had been days of thaw. Maddie had been right to worry about the state of the ice. I scanned the center of the lake for the telltale dark streaks of open water. All was flat and white. I climbed over the heave at the shoreline and shuffled forward slowly, barely lifting my feet. The surface was ugly, grainy, made of snow that had melted to slush and then refrozen in the recent snap. I raised 1 foot high and stamped. The lake didn't protest. No groans or squeaks, no terrifying crack. I made my way forward over deeper water, walking heavily now, bouncing to bring the full force of my weight down on the ice. I imagined falling through, me and the other one, sinking through that cold water to the bottom. "Wait, Aunt Mattie, wait for us!" Ruth's voice piped from the shore. I turned and waved to them. Matilda stood small and still, wrapped in a hooded maroon cloak that had belonged to our mother. It made me shiver to think how loyal she was, ready to do what I asked, trusting it would be all right as long as I said so. Ruth, brilliant in her bright red coat, was pulling hard on her mother's mittened hand, letting her head and shoulders hang precariously over the ground. She knew her mother would never let her go. I didn't think then that my baby could be like that someday. I didn't think, really, about my baby at all. I concentrated solely on getting us to the island. It seemed the only thing that I could do. We set Ruth on the sled, and Matilda balanced her and the load while I pulled. The closer we got to the island, the smoother the ice became, until finally the sled began to overtake me. I stopped pulling and grabbed onto the side opposite Mattie, and we let it drag us both forward almost more quickly than we could find our footing. I nearly fell, and then Mattie almost went down, and then I again, while we whizzed along, slipping and laughing, all three just children out for an afternoon slide. The island was ringed with a jagged collar the ice had pushed up in its aggressive expansion, as if it were trying to climb onto the land. We had to circle twice before finding a spot low and gently pitched enough for Mattie to scramble over and help Ruth and me after her. We left our sled of supplies on the ice and went to see how the house had fared, closed up for so long. The house, painted a soft gray with green trim, looked in the summer as if it had grown there, but in winter it stood out among the bare black trees. We opened the door to musty wood and chilly, motionless air. Maybe Rudy was right, I thought. Maybe we couldn't live here, two women all alone. "We'll have to get this going first thing," Mattie said, opening the door of the wood stove. Mattie and Carl had lived just fine on the island in the cold, I reminded myself. Mattie knew what she was doing. We would get through this last little bit of wintry weather, and then it would be spring. "I'll get some wood," I said. Crossing my arms over my tender breasts, I stood for a moment on the porch steps, surveying the vast, flat whiteness that was the lake and the cross-hatched black that marked the shoreline. Through the trees I could see the roof of the Tully's barn. In an hour or two, people would be lighting their lamps and their windows would shine among the trees like eyes, staring at us, exposed here on the ice. Maybe there was no hiding here. Maybe this place was a mistake. But by summer, I assured myself, piling wood into the curve of my arm, it would be different. By summer, the island would be shrouded in leaves, and I could keep my business to myself, with no one the wiser. Ruth. Aunt Mandy had a mouth at the bottom of her thumb. "What's this?" I asked her. My finger petted the white circle on her tan skin. We were sitting in the big green chair, me squeezed between the arm and her, because that is how we like to sit. "Is this from your mama?" Aunt Mandy said. "She gave this to me, so I would remember to listen to her."
"What does she say?"
"Never leave Ruthie. That's what she says. Never leave Ruth." Aunt Mandy didn't mind my mama. She did leave me. But then she came back. One morning in May, when Amanda had been home from St. Michael's for about a month, and the sun was dewing the grass outside in a way that promised summer, Carl and Ruth sat at the kitchen table waiting for their breakfasts. "One of these nice days, Ruth," Carl said, "I'll take you out to the island where you and I lived with your mama. How would you like that?"
"No,"
Amanda said. She slapped the pan of eggs she'd been about to bring to the table back on the stove. "This darn hot pad burned right through it." Carl looked at her, surprised.
"What?"
"She wouldn't like it. Ruth doesn't like the water."
"Yes, she does.
You like the water, don't you, Ruth?" Ruth looked from her father to her aunt and wasn't sure what would be right to say, so she said nothing.
"I want you to close that place," Amanda said, her hands on her hips. "Board it up. Nail it shut and forget about it. I can't believe you'd want to take Ruth there after, well, after everything. What's the matter with you? Carl looked at his empty plate. Maybe there was something the matter with him, for he wanted Ruth to see the place where she'd begun. It bothered him that Amanda had managed to wipe Matilda from Ruth's life. As far as he knew, she told the child nothing about what had happened before his return, nor would she let him speak of the time before he'd left. It'll only make her sad, she'd told him. She's lucky she was too young to remember. He agreed with Amanda in principle. What good would it do Ruth to know that her mother could swim like a sunfish and liked her bacon crisp? What difference would it make to her to hear about the day Maddie had braided her a crown of black-eyed Susans and chicory? But still, he wanted her to know, for Maddie's sake. Maybe Amanda could let Matilda disappear, as if she'd never been, but he couldn't. He waited for a Tuesday, Amanda's day to go to town, and he told himself he was only doing what she'd asked. He was boarding the place up, wasn't he? And he couldn't leave Ruth at home all by herself. He found her under the lilacs, the cat's tail slipping through her hands, and he scooped her up from behind and hoisted her into the air. "You're coming with me today, young lady." He kissed her neck, smelling her young skin smell. She, suddenly tall enough to be among the flowers, lifted her face to the fragrant purple. "Where?" "You'll see." He set her down, picked up his toolbox, and led her along the lilac hedge to the back of the yard, where he held the leafy branches open and motioned for her to step first onto the path into the woods. "For a walk?" she asked, used to traveling this path with Amanda. "You'll see." The trail was narrow, and she scampered ahead like a rabbit, squatting before a lavender hepatica on the right, scaring a scarlet tanager from its perch on the left, drifting back to the right to peel off a white curl of birch bark. Carl limped, tried to stretch and flex his bad leg. He passed her as she knelt before a patch of moss and stroked its spores with her palms. He rounded a bend, and she ran to overtake him. At the giant oak where she and Amanda always turned back, she stopped and waited. He took her hand and they proceeded. She, more circumspect, somewhat awed, although there was little difference between the part of the woods they now walked in and the part through which they just passed. He sensed her holding back, her stride shortening and slowing, until, finally, her shoulder was skewed and he was nearly dragging her forward. "What's the matter, Ruthie?" They stopped, still several yards from the shore, and he squatted to look into her face. "It's all right. It's just water, like a bath, a giant bathtub." He looked across the calm surface, swollen with mild waves, and was pleased with the comparison. "Just like a bathtub." But she squeezed her eyes shut and turned her head away, as if he were trying to force her to swallow medicine. Helplessly, Carl looked east along the shoreline. "We need to wait for Mr. Tully, anyway." When he released her hand, she stood firm and even looked up, studying the water. A good sign. Encouraged, he sat on the ground, pulled off his boots, and rolled up his pants legs. "Well, I'm going in." He picked his way gingerly forward, the sharp stones in the cool water shocking his soft white feet. When the water reached to his rolled cuff, he turned carefully, grappling for footing on the bruising rocks. He looked back at her across that narrow span of water. She stood small and scared, the weeds nearly up to her waist. Looking at her that way, he saw for the first time in her wide mouth, in the hint of the plane that would be her finished cheek, in the angle of her ears, not Matilda's face as before, but his own. It was a shock, that recognition. How could he not have seen it earlier? He felt a surge of connection with Ruth that could have been nothing other than love, and he wanted to pick her up and lock her fiercely against his chest. But at the same time, seeing how small she was, and how scared, how utterly helpless and alone, he also felt something else, something that made him dip his hand into the water. The water that was, after all, not like a bath, but cold and vast, uncontainable. Dip his hand deep, nearly up to the elbow, and then raise his arm and flick the water from his fingertips toward her. "Toughen up," he thought. The spray was gentle, so light, really, and at such a distance that it couldn't possibly have hit her, not a single drop, and he smiled quickly, as if it had all been a joke. Still, she began to cry. He hurried toward her, wincing at the stones and the noise, both, "It's all right. He knelt beside her, wrapping his arms around her. I'm sorry. It's all right.
Joe Tully's boat scraped against the rocks, and he climbed out, plopping his heavy shoes into the water, but then hung back, awkwardly.
Did she fall? Did she hurt herself?
No, no, she's fine. She's just a little scared.
Maybe you better take her home.
No, she'll be all right.
You'll be fine, won't you, Ruthie?
Sure you will. Ruth had stopped crying, and though she seemed to be looking at Tully, she was, in fact, looking beyond him at his boat. Carl got to his feet, and the men shook hands.
Thanks for coming out, Joe.
Joe nodded. He never knew how to respond to the thanks people were always pressing on him. He winked at Ruth.
She's growing like a weed, he said,
knowing that was what he was supposed to say about little children.
And Amanda?
He added, looking back at Carl.
She's all right now, is she?
I've heard... He glanced down at his feet for a moment, started afresh.
Well, she's doing fine, is she?
She's doing fine, Joe.
Come by for dinner this noon and see for yourself.
I might do that, if you think it's all right. I mean, if you think she wouldn't mind.
I'm sure she'd be happy to see you, Joe,
Carl said absently, brushing the mud from his knees. Ruth sat in the very center of the boat and kept her face toward the land.
I saved Amanda's hat right about here once, Joe said as he pulled on the oars. A straw one with a blue ribbon. Does she still have that, I wonder?
But he looked over his shoulder then at the island, not wanting Carl to answer, embarrassed that he'd even remembered such a thing. Carl, staring out across the water, thinking private thoughts, said nothing. Long before there was a house on the island, Matilda had brought Carl there.
This is it, she'd announced.
He held one oar clumsily out of the water and puzzled over how he was supposed to get both unwieldy things into the boat. He had insisted on being the one to row, though she was an expert, and he could hardly keep the boat from spinning. He glanced at her, not sure whether he hoped she would offer advice or pay no attention. She was perched on the gunwale, a precarious place. He was just about to say, "Look out, be careful," when she threw her head back, and before he could shout, almost before he could open his mouth, she lost her balance, fell backward into the water, and was gone. He scrambled forward to the spot where she'd gone in. The water showed no sign of her. That was what made him hesitate, not knowing where she might be, not having any clue at all, not a ripple, not a bubble. Otherwise, he would have leaped in after her, although he couldn't swim. Later, he told himself that over and over. If he'd known where to jump, he'd have gone right in. And then he heard her voice. Carl? He heard her voice, but she wasn't there. Carl, over here! It was coming from behind him. Somehow, she'd got all the way to the other side of the boat without his knowing. Her head, with her hair pushed down around it, was sleek as a muskrat's. The water rippled around her shoulders, but she was clearly standing on the bottom. She laughed at him, laughed at the fear on his face. Here I am, Carl. Did you think I'd drowned? All Carl could think, once he knew she was safe, once it was clear that it had just been a joke, was that he hadn't gone in after her. He told himself later that he'd known she was all right, but it wasn't true. He told himself that he would have jumped once he was sure, in another second, maybe two. Who knew what he would have done, just given a little more time? But secretly, he knew he'd been tested and had failed. To make up for it, he swung his legs over the side and slipped in, gasping as the cold water reached the sensitive skin of his stomach. She laughed and started away from him toward the shore. He pushed after her.
I'll get you, I'll get you!
It was an awkward chase. Their feet slipped on the rocks, the water held them back. Still, he was stronger, faster. He did catch her, first a bit of her sleeve, then her whole arm. She spun around to face him, and for one confused instant he had no idea what to do with her now that he had her. But she knew. She tilted her face invitingly, and he kissed her. She led him on a merry chase, Carl thought fondly. She'd gone out for an evening with him and then danced too often with other fellows. She'd broken dates at the last minute with no excuse. She'd provoked arguments and cried and declared she never wanted to see him again. But he'd caught her at last. One fall night when the air was cold and sharp, the words just slipped out of him, as if they'd been summoned by something beyond his will. Marry me. And what had she said? He couldn't remember, but it must have been yes, or sure, or all right, because soon enough they were married.
Joe feathered the oars when they reached the island so that the boat bumped very gently against the rocks, and then Ruth was lifted again, swung through the air, and set on her feet on the dry land, a different land entirely. At a little distance among the thick trees and weeds stood a gray and green house.
"There should be some lumber back behind the outhouse," Carl said, taking Ruth's hand and leading the way up the overgrown path.
He stopped, though, a few feet back from the front steps.
"Should we take a quick look inside?"
He seemed to be asking the house itself.
Joe yawned. What Carl ought to do was sell that place and concentrate on what he had that was good. But everyone was a fool about something.
"Sure, whatever you want."
Carl flexed his knees and stomped once or twice on each of the steps up to the porch. The house's solidness pleased him, since he'd built most of it himself. But then, he thought, why shouldn't the place be in good shape? It was only 5 years old. He'd thought he and Matilda would go to Chicago or maybe even Toronto, and as long as his plans were vague, she'd been enthusiastic. When he realized that, in fact, she couldn't stand the idea of moving away, they were already married, and he accepted her father's offer to pay for the materials for a cabin on the island. He was surprised now at how small the place seemed, almost as if it were a scaled-down model of the house he'd known so intimately. In the kitchen, Carl peered into the cupboards at the familiar china, white with green ships painted on the rims, another gift from her parents. They'd moved in as soon as one room was habitable, and there'd been so much happy momentum at first. He'd worked for her father on the farm, rowing over every morning at dawn. For a while, Matilda went with him to help her mother, but then she began to stay on the island to work on the house alone, accomplishing much more than he expected, even during the month or so when she always seemed to be sick. She cleared brush, drew plans for more rooms, painted the porch ceiling pale blue. In the evenings, he brought George or Wally and Rudy or a couple of the other hired men, and they floated the lumber along behind them on a raft and added the bedrooms and a real kitchen. Just as it was growing too dark to see, they would hear a shout from the pier and would drop their tools and hurry down to help Amanda with her baskets of cold chicken and potato salad and pickles and rhubarb pie. Often Mary Louise, George's wife, would come along, and it was like a party. Every night a party with Carl and Matilda and their house and their island right in the middle of it all. But in September, the life of the place drifted away. Amanda went off to Madison to go to nursing school. The fishermen and boaters dwindled, too, when the temperature dropped and the lake lay quiet under the brittle autumn air. The leaves fell, and in every direction the water and the land beyond seemed more vast, and Carl and Matilda, left to themselves in the center of it, more tiny and alone. The warped drawer Joe had been pulling on came open with a crack.
"Hey, pencils," he said. "We could use a couple of these if we need to cut down some of that wood."
"Sure, take them."
Joe left the drawer open and Carl glanced into it. Among the pencil stubs and paper scraps and the odd springs and screws and spools, he saw a slim silver penknife. Where had Matilda gotten that? He plucked it out, slipped it into his pocket, and followed Joe outside. Carl hadn't built shutters, so he and Joe had to improvise with the lumber stacked behind the outhouse. It was simple work, really. They measured a window, cut pieces to fit against the sill and the top of the window frame, then more pieces to span the height of the window, and nail them together.
"Must have been cozy living here," Joe said, holding a finished cover over one of the row of windows that ran the length of the enclosed porch so that Carl could nail it in place.
"Cozy? Sure, I guess."
Carl swung his hammer steadily. Thinking back, he supposed it had been cozy. On the island, he and Matilda had had a sort of honeymoon that went on and on for months. That was what Carl remembered, how happily they'd clung to one another before the war. That was the story he told himself now on the nights when he couldn't sleep. At the time, though, he'd felt a little afraid when he and Matilda were there all alone. He loved her, of course, he never doubted that. But nevertheless, he felt almost as if, well, this was strange, but almost as if he'd been taken prisoner. He knew it didn't make sense, especially since he actually left the island every day. It was Matilda who was trapped, if anyone was, but she didn't seem to mind. The canoe was always there for her, but she seldom used it.
Most evenings she was waiting for him on the little pier when he rowed home, and wrapped herself around him almost before he was completely out of the boat. More than once, she nearly pulled both of them into the water with her exuberant embrace. She told him in exhaustive detail about every moment of her day, every shrub she'd cleared, every rooster she'd stenciled on the kitchen wall, every stray thought that had occurred to her throughout the day. She sang and danced. One day she decided yellow would be best for the baby's room. The next day she decided blue. The next week it was yellow again, definitely yellow. She told him that the lake wasn't as cold as one might think. And wasn't it funny how she'd hated school as a child? And why shouldn't a woman vote if she wanted to? But she would never bother personally. And hadn't the sunset been gorgeous, just gorgeous? And she would laugh at herself and at his confusion, and at her own complete happiness. And he would laugh, too, uneasily, glad that she was happy, but not at all sure of it, not at all certain that they were on firm ground. Because at other times the house was dark and still, the curtains drawn, when he docked the rowboat. He found her sitting on the porch in the darkness, sucking on a strand of hair, or curled in the bed, her eyes swollen with crying. Sometimes she was terrified about the baby. What if it died? What if it came out wrong? What if it was a monster? Or she was convinced the water was rising. The wind would carry her away. The lightning would strike him down in the fields. Or she had merely burned the supper. She was no good as a wife. She would be no good as a mother. He never should have married her. These were the things she said. "My pretty bird," he said, sitting beside her on the bed. "Don't worry. Everything will be all right." "You don't know that," she said scornfully. And, of course, she was right. But in Carl's experience, it was what people said when they didn't know what else to do. But while he was frying potatoes and eggs, she would appear at the kitchen table, her bathrobe fastened with a bow around her thickening waist, and gradually her euphoria would return, until once again she was regaling him with stories of the spelling bees she'd won, and the boys who'd kissed her behind the school, and the afternoon she and Amanda had stolen away from their chores to this very island together. She laid his hand against her swelling stomach, so he could feel how tight her skin was growing, how well the baby was developing. She talked on and on about her plans, about all the children they would have, how the farm would prosper with his help, how they would buy more land and more cows, how they would build a second story onto their island house. Increasingly, though, he found it difficult to listen to her describe the myriad ways in which she was nailing them to this spot, to this course of life. He had become convinced that he didn't like farming much, and he wasn't good at it. At least that was what his father-in-law made clear every time he turned away in disgust, or stepped in with a sigh to take over a job that he thought Carl was performing awkwardly or not quickly enough. One night Carl told Matilda how her father had shoved him so hard when he was filing one of Frenchie's hoofs that he'd sprawled on the barn floor under the horse. "You've got to be gentle with her," Mr. Starkey had grunted, easing his hand along the horse's foreleg until she lifted her foot again. He gripped the hoof between his knees. "She's not a slab of beef, you know." Matilda turned away from him, reaching for one of the books she kept piled near their bed. "You have to understand," she said. "He's had Frenchie all her life. He knows what's best for her." The hand she put on his shoulder then to comfort him stung. "There's a lot you can learn from him, you know, if you give him a chance." But Carl knew Mr. Starkey wasn't trying to teach him about horses. Carl and Joe finished covering the porch windows and started down the south side of the house. Joe talked off and on about the almanac's predictions for that summer's weather, about the new variety of cow corn he'd planted, about the way the fish seemed to have moved from the west side of Taylor's Bay to the east that spring. By February, the tiny girl Carl had married was transformed into a woman whose every footfall pounded through the house. She bossed him, demanding that he rearrange the furniture, repair a window frame that allowed a draft, sand a rough spot on the floorboards. Every morning she gave him a list of things to bring back from the farmhouse or from town. Blankets and pillows, soap and crackers, knitting needles of various sizes, Rugs and books and bottles and wood and wood and wood, always more wood for the stove, until she'd built a stockpile big enough to last 3 years. He pulled the stuff in a sled over the ice, which looked, under a glaze of snow, as soft and black as the skin of a plum. There was very little work to do on the farm. In the mornings, Carl cut ice on Taylor's Bay and dragged it up Glacier Road to the ice house. On clear afternoons, Matilda wanted to skate. "It won't be perfect again for years," she'd said. "I can't let a chance like this go by." And when he'd protested that she couldn't risk falling because of the baby, she'd scoffed, "I'm not going to fall, Carl. I know what I'm doing." He hadn't known how to stop her, and, after all, she turned out to be right. She skated carefully, easing her ungainly weight from one leg to the other. He could see why she liked it. On the ice, she could move as gracefully as ever. And if, occasionally, she needed to grip his arm to steady herself, well, he was there, wasn't he? He'd make sure nothing happened to her. But later he hadn't been there. Carl remembered Amanda's impatient words. She probably thought it was a fine night for skating and fell through. That would be just like her. Maybe it was true. Maybe Matilda had been reckless, had gone out skating late in the night because she couldn't sleep and the ice seemed perfect. Maybe that was the end of the story, and there was nothing to blame but the treacherous ice. Ruth had arrived with the slush of spring. She was light, buoyant even, and yet when the midwife first shifted the tiny bundle into his arms, he felt as if he might drop her. So heavy was she with helplessness, with the need to be protected at all costs. He knew he could not let her fall ever, in any way. He braced himself proudly to bear that enormous weight, but the moment she opened her blue-gray eyes, he felt the first gentle bite of doubt. He was overcome with weakness in his arms, and such a weakness in his legs that he had to sit down. Matilda was always asking him to feed the stove. The windows must not be opened. The door must be shut promptly. The house was stifling. He felt sorry for the baby, swaddled so tightly in all those blankets, only her pink face showing. What if she was frightened? What if she was too hot? How would they know? One night in the third week of Ruth's life, Matilda didn't awaken when the baby began to cry. Carl edged out of the bed, happy to let his exhausted wife sleep. He lifted his daughter from her bed, and for a minute or so she quietly gummed his shoulder. When she began to whimper, he carried her out of the bedroom and into the front room, his feet freezing on the cold floorboards. He sat and rocked her as her whimpers turned to cries, stood and swayed with her as her cries became howls. He swooped her up and down, his hand firmly cradling her soft skull and weak neck. He jiggled her very gently and danced with her and held her tight against his neck, and still she cried, screamed to the limit of every breath, as if there were nothing in her but anguish. "Stop that! What are you doing to her?" Matilda set her candle on the table, plucked Ruth from his arms, and put her on her breast. The baby didn't stop crying instantly, but soon enough, and Carl was relieved, although also a little angry with her. Was that all Ruth cared about? Something he couldn't give her? Disgusted then with himself for resenting an infant, he solicitously wrapped a blanket around his wife's shoulders and settled a pillow under her elbow. "You were just hungry, weren't you?" Matilda crooned to her baby's feathery scalp. Daddy didn't understand. She seemed pleased, he thought, to be able to do what he could not. "Put more wood in the stove, Carl," Matilda said. "It's freezing in here." He filled the stove, and then he left them, mother and daughter, together, and went alone to bed. Carl drove more nails in, sealed the top of the shutter, then the bottom. Shadows of round young leaves splattered against the sunny wall. Three sides of the house were closed. The job was nearly finished. Here, now, with the cozy house before him, the memory of his wife and baby girl snug inside. He was ashamed of his once fierce desperation to show Matilda he did not belong to her, not the way she thought. She might have her island, her house, her father's farm, her child, but she didn't have him. Even so, he would never have thought of really leaving her. But going to war wasn't leaving. A man was supposed to be a soldier. A man was supposed to do his duty. And then, when he returned, her father would have to stop shaking his head, and things would be different.
She would what? What did he want from her? She had screamed and fallen to the ground when he told her he had not taken his exemption for dependents.
You've denied Ruth, she said. You've denied me?
No, he hadn't done that, had he? That wasn't what he'd meant. He'd only meant not to make excuses, not to weasel out like a coward. It wasn't as if Maddie and Ruth truly depended on him. She'd ordered him to go back, to tell them it had been a mistake. She had pounded the floor with her fist in an agony of emotion. She had sworn that he would die, that she would die without him. Then she told him coldly that he would be sorry. Then she'd announced that she and Ruth would go along, would stay outside his camp, would take a steamer all the way to France. And then she had simply cried. He was sorry, but also relieved. He wanted to take it back and tell her that she had no reason to cry, but he also felt calm in the knowledge that it was too late. There was nothing he could do. All he could offer her was, "I'll be back. You'll see, I'll be back before you know it." He tried to raise her face to kiss her. "I may not be here then," she said, looking at him with hatred. Carl's hammer slipped from his fingers and fell to the ground. Until this very moment, he'd forgotten those words. But she hadn't meant them, he knew that. She'd only said them in anger. He bent to retrieve the hammer and wipe the dirt out of the claw. He pounded 5 nails into the cover Joe was holding over the last window in the final wall.
"Mama!"
The scream was coming from inside the house, now completely boarded shut. "Ruth!" How had he forgotten her, Carl thought, running for the door. Joe began to pry open the cover they had just nailed in place. "Here I am, Ruth!" Carl threw the door open and a swatch of sunlight ran down the middle of the dark house. "Here I am!" He found her, finally, under the bed in the back room that had been his and Matilda's. "It's all right, sweetheart. Everything's all right," he said. "We didn't know you were still in here, that's all. Don't worry, everything will be all right." Unlike Matilda, Ruth believed those words. She let him comfort her as he walked through the dim house, checking window locks and closing doors. Back outside, he gently pried her arms loose and lowered her to the ground. In one hand, she clutched a green sack cinched with a leather thong. "Where'd you get this?" Matilda had snatched the bag when he'd brought it home for Ruth.
"Marbles for a baby? Are you crazy? She'll choke."
The thought horrified him, and she softened when she saw the look on his face.
"It's all right, Carl. We'll save them for her. She'll love them when she gets older."
"And," she added, he remembered this now with a pang for her kindness, "I always love marbles. Ruth is a lucky girl." Then she tied the thong extra tight and deposited the sack in the bottom of the toy chest. Joe, Carl, and Ruth came quietly up the path to the farmhouse. But before they reached the door, the screen snapped open and smacked against the wall. Amanda stalked across the porch, grabbed Ruth by the shoulders, and drew her against her skirts. "Hello, Joseph," she said, nodding curtly at him. "You'll stay to dinner, won't you?" Without waiting for his answer, she looked down at Ruth and shook her lightly. "Where have you been? You're a mess." She did not look at Carl. She slid the ribbons from the ends of the child's braids, raked her fingers through her hair, and then began to rebraid tightly.
"We went to the water. Ouch! It hurts. And it got dark."
"Run along and show Mr. Tully where to wash up for dinner," Amanda said, giving her a little push between the shoulder blades toward the house. The voices rose over the squeaking of the pump handle and the rush of water in the sink.
"The lake? To the lake? How could you do such a thing?"
"What's wrong with taking her there? That's what I'd like to know. For crying out loud, she was born there."
"You have no right to go there now."
"What do you mean, I have no right? It's my house, isn't it?"
"You wouldn't know anything about it, Carl. You weren't there. You left her."
"Oh, that again."
"Yes, that again. If you hadn't left your wife and child, Maddie never..."
Ruth stood in one corner of the doorway, pressed against the screen.
"Hey, Ruthie, where'd this come from?"
Joe lifted the sack Ruth had dropped in the toolbox.
"You know what I think is in here, Ruthie?"
He tossed the sack up and down, catching it in one hand. "I think these are marbles. How about you and me play a game of marbles before dinner, Ruthie? Come on." When she didn't move, he went to her, peeled her gently off the screen, and drew her into the room. "Do you know how to play marbles, Ruthie? Here, I'll show you." She was interested in the colors of the little clay and glass balls, and in their cool smoothness. She wanted to study them, to line them up, maybe to watch them roll, to rub them between her palms. But she tried to hold her fingers the way he showed her, tried to bend her thumb right. Finally, he let her just roll them, aim and roll them, so that sometimes they knocked against each other with a satisfying click. Ruth. We walked where Aunt Mattie and I always walk, and then when it came time for let's turn around, better get home, gotta get the supper on the table, we didn't stop. We kept going where I didn't know the path went, and then there were blue spaces between the trunks and under the branches, and then the water. I remembered the water, a sky on the ground, where you fall and fall and fall and fall. We were at heaven, and I was afraid, because that's where you go when you die. The water was lumpy with ripply skin. We went on it in a boat, and the shore didn't look anything like the place where we'd been standing, even though I knew we had been standing right there. And then the boat bumped on another shore. "Do you remember this, Ruth?" he asked. "We lived here when you were a tiny baby, Mama and you and I." "I can't remember when I was a baby," I told him. "I think I was a good baby. I think I didn't cry."
"All babies cry, Ruth."
"No, I didn't." I knew the smell inside the house, wet wood and mittens, and the green smell of the water. It was the smell where my mama was. I looked for her. I looked in the secret spaces, under the red blanket, under the beds and in drawers, where her smell was so strong, I thought she must be standing behind me, but she wasn't. I found a mouse house made of scarf and paper, but I didn't find her. Still, I knew Aunt Mandy was wrong. Here was where she should be waiting. Here was where she would come back. In the kitchen, I looked in the cupboards. I found a bowl, a cup, and a frying pan with cottony nests of spiders' eggs in the bottom. I stood on a chair to look where the pencils were. I remembered her sharpening with the knife. "There you go, Ruthie. Keep it on the paper. That's a girl." Then half the sun that lay on the kitchen floor disappeared. That was when the pounding started. Pound, pound, pound. Quiet. Pound, pound, pound. The other half of the sun was gone then, too. In the other rooms, there was still light, so I went to the room with the chest where my toys lived. There were leaves in the chest, and sticks, and snail shells, and rocks that had been green and red and blue and yellow under the water, but they'd all turned brown in the chest. "Look, here's a pretty one," she said. She was good at finding the pretty ones, and she gave them all to me. The pounding came again. Pound, 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 quiet. Pound, 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 quiet. Mama's skates were in the chest. I felt the soft inside where her feet went in, but I remembered about the shiny part. "Never touch," she said. She put wooden sticks over the silver. The little green sack was in the chest. "For when you're older," she said. 5 is older. There were stones in the sack. You could tell by how heavy it was, by how it clicked and clacked when you moved it. They were pretty ones, I bet. The string was tight. She could have got it undone, or even Aunt Mandy, but I couldn't. I took the sack to Mama's room and sat on the green rug beside the bed where we said, "Now I lay me down to sleep." I use my teeth. I have good teeth. One of them is gray from when I fell down the stairs, but it works just like the white ones. The string was leather. Tasted nice and felt good in my mouth. I worked on it. I'm a good worker. That's what Aunt Mandy says. I worked on it until I got it loose. The stones inside were pretty. Some of them were soft red-brown like flower pots, but the best ones were jewels, colors like stick candy. All of them were perfectly round. They rolled when I set them on the floor. They rolled into the grooves of the braid on the rug, and 2 of them, a lemon and a cinnamon, rolled under the bed. Under the bed was where to go the day the noises were scary. "Go to your room," Mama said, but I didn't want to go. They were angry. They scolded me. "Go away now, Ruthie," they said. But I went under the bed in the dark and low. Aunt Mandy bent down. "Here now, see? Shush now. Aunt Mandy's got candy." I didn't want candy. I wanted to stay, but Mama said no. "Go to your room. There's nothing to be scared of." But I could see that wasn't true. Under the bed is a good place to hide when you hear the screaming, when you hear the breathing, when you hear the, "God! Oh, God! Oh, God!" In the dark and low, on the "Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep," I shush and suck and suck. I suck my candy sharp as a needle. I lay me down to sleep, and then I wake. Still there are the noises. They won't stop making the noises. I hold my hands over my ears, but still they won't stop. Back and forth go Mama's shoes, back and forth until I'm tired, until the baby cries, and then it's quiet. I put the stones in the bag, and then there was the pounding right over my head. And then all the light went away. It was dark as night. Dark as the water when I couldn't get up. Mama! I screamed. Mama! I found where she was, but she wasn't there. And then he came. He lifted me.